Welcome everyone, and it's nice to be here. I was I did my PhD in the group of Tony Asin with Jacopo. So this work is like actually this collection of works were done there together with Jacopo and another couple of people. I will present you at the end of the talk. And basically, our main research interest is how information theory interplays with physical evolutions. So in order to be all on the same page, let's introduce the two main concepts we will be speaking about. One is what is a dynamics for a quantum system, and the other one is what is information. So let's start with the uncontroversial one, what is dynamics for quantum systems. Well, if you have a state, pi, we know that the canonical formalism quantum mechanics tells you that this will be mapped to a later time t to a map that satisfies two properties. One is this, that if you adjoin, I mean, if you tensor your map with the identity and then you act on any state, the state will remain positive. And the other property is that normalization is preserved, meaning that probabilities don't increase in time. And this is the definition of what mathematically are called completely positive trace preserving maps, CPTP. And basically, a CP map means that it maps, I mean, a map is CP if it maps a state into a positive state into a positive state together with an ancilla. If you don't have the ancilla requirement, it's just called positive map, so P map. In this class, there's a special family called the unitaries that are described, that are all of this form, where U is a unitary matrix. And they shared the special property that these are the only CPT maps that are physically invertible. So it means that there's another map that you can actually implement that reverse completely your dynamics. And another way of saying it is that unitaries actually preserve the information about the initial state in which you were. And this is a principle that, I mean, from a foundational point of view, the fact that information is conserved over time is something that we would like to keep. So in order to join this fact that we have CPT maps for general physical evolution with the fact that actually these are not invertible, we use this theorem by Steenespin that tells you that actually all CPT maps are described in this way. That going into it basically means that you have all physical maps are this form in which you adjoin, you tensor it with an uncorrelated ancillary state, you evolved it unitarily, and then there's some correlation that gets created, and all the reversibility you get only comes from this last operation you do, that is the partial trace of the ancillary part. So in some sense, and this is what we started off with, this phi t. So basically, what Steenespring theorem actually is telling you that is that all physical evolutions are the marginal of a unitary on a bigger system.
Could I ask a question before you go?
Yeah.
Isn't it kind of important where you put the t's in these equations? I know it seems completely unimportant, but are you talking about continuous evolutions or finite evolutions over a finite amount of time?
I'm being sloppy here. So it's like...
and my question is really, I think it's important not to be sloppy.
Yeah, okay. So basically everything I will say until the point in which you speak about Markovianity, because we will speak about that as well, is it applies both to the finite version and the infinitesimal one. And for this reason, at least in this very introductory part, I'm very sloppy. But in principle, I think it's best for the purpose of the exposition to always assume you have like a differential like evolution, so some like infinitesimal evolution, continuous in time. But anyways, it's like the main theorem applies also for a finite step, like a finite CPT. And yeah, basically, did you have a question? Oh, no, sorry. Okay, thanks. And something that can happen is that actually your system, you didn't interact with it, you didn't trace away the ancillary system, the ancillary part of the environment, and then it just continues to a later time. And then depending on at which point you do the trace on the rest of the universe, well, you will have definitely these two maps that are CP by construction, because the composition of two unitaries still are unitary. But now the question is, what happens to this map in between? Well, actually, first, if you have a group of maps, it's not always given that this property holds, that is, that there is this map phi st, which is called the intermediate maps, that maps the map at time t to a later time s. When this is the case, this family of maps is called divisible. That is, there is exists an intermediate map for all division of, like for all time s and all time t. And then something one might ask is, well, looks quite similar to our CPT maps. Is it CP? Well, actually, this is not the case. And the fact that that intermediate map is CP corresponds to a very strong physical requirement. That is, the evolution overall should be Markovian. And the reason why we identify what is called CP divisibility with the Markovianity is the following. Let's start from the beginning again, and we do the first part of the evolution. Then you trace out the environment, and you know that this part is described by the by your map until time t. The fact that the intermediate map is physical, as is CP, means that there exists another ancillary state and another unitary that you can apply to your partial state now, and then continue the evolution. And this will basically map you. Sorry, there's a problem with the, this should be S. Map you to a later time. That is, Markovianity tells you that the evolution does not need access to the information that your original state had about the initial state in which you were in order to continue. Or to say the opposite, if an evolution is non-Markovian, in order to be mapped to a later time, you have to access your ancillary state. Otherwise, you have no physical way of continuing the dynamics. And basically, this is everything you will need for this talk about dynamics. If you have questions, this is the right moment to ask.
So I want to apologize for asking my question, because you gave a very clear account of it almost immediately.
Okay, thanks.
Here, the phi in a circle, it's like another ancillary state?
Yeah, this is another state. Okay. And I mean, when I plot it like this, this is means a tensor product between the two. So it's like you take another state that is uncorrelated with your final state, and then you continue. So now we spoke about dynamics. What about information? So information it's a bit of a more controversial thing to define, and it has, for me, like a long definition and a short definition. The long definition is that information is the minimal amount of bits you need to describe an object. Like the object brings to you that amount of information, quantify the minimum amount of bits that you use to it to basically define it. This is the long definition because it's incredibly difficult to actually work with the with this definition. It goes a long way in algorithmic complexity theory. It's like all a field, very esoteric. And what we are usually working with is the short definition, that information about an object is actually contained in a probability distribution that, if you sample from it, will give you something that resembles your object. Whereas this might look a bit complicated, and I think, like in the 50s when this thing was introduced by Shannon, was, I don't know how people actually bought this thing. Now that we have generative neural networks, it's easier to understand what's the idea behind it. Because a neural network actually works like this. So you have, basically, let's say you have a network that generates an image, given some initial input. And then if the network is untrained, well, what you will get is some kind of random noise. But as the training goes on and on, you will get something that resembles more and more what you mean by your concept. And actually, even if all the machine learning community makes it very esoteric, everything that is going on is just a gradient descent in order to approximate a probability distribution associated to whatever is written on the left. And in fact, whenever you write dog, what you see is that this machine basically starts sampling from it. And you never get by the construction of the machine, you never get two dogs that are the same, because they depend on the random seed that the machine is using to generate your figure. So in this way, we see that we say that the machine has learned about what a dog is if the statistics that the machine is generating approximate what we think as the concept of a dog. But this is all very subject related, so it would be nice to give a way of objectively quantifying how far away two probability distributions are. And this is basically the main topic of information theory. And one of the canonical way of doing it is you take a distribution P, and you start sampling from it in a basically independent manner, and you do n times a sampling from this probability distribution. Then you do the same with another probability distribution. Let's say this is your target distribution, and this is what you have. And then a standard way of comparing it is just saying, okay, this my target probability distribution is good if this ratio is close to 1. Because basically, I'm checking the probability of a very long sequence. If I had a good guess, well, this will be very close to 1. As soon as it's a worse guess, well, it decays exponentially. And how does it so? Well, thanks to the fact that these are independent variables, you can factorize everything. And if you take the exponential and the logarithm again, so nothing fancy in there, but just taking the exponential, the logarithm of each of the factors, and then exponentiating again, you can actually apply the law of large numbers. That is, as soon as you multiply and divide by n, you have an average in the exponent, and this average, for for n big enough, can be approximated by its average value according to the real distribution that we said is p. And this is basically the operational interpretation of the relative entropy that we all know and love. That is, the relative entropy is just the exponent of quantifying how fast two probability distributions like will differ as you continue to compare their statistics.
Can I ask a question? This is really boggling my brain. So you first started talking about neural networks.
Yeah.
And then, no, I love this. and you basically showed that it becomes this multi-valued function,
mm-hmm.
right? And then you switch this paradigm from you've got this multi-valued function to mm-hmm. that's just the same thing as sampling from a distribution.
Yeah.
That's cool. So this thing called p-dog isn't what the neural network is doing. It's this new way of describing the multiple values
of
the neural network. I just wanted to make sure we're on the same page.
Yeah. Actually, you can even have a neural network that does just probabilities, like just creates images for dogs. And then there's no p-dog, there's p, and that's it.
Oh, you mean you can go the other way and identify the picture.
Yeah. So, but usually when you have a more general neural network, it's multivariate,
okay,
as you say.
Okay, so in a sense, what the neural network is, do you like fiber bundles? Can I use that?
Yeah.
Yeah, so you've got all of these different pictures of dogs
mm-hmm.
that evaluate to the point dog in the fold of words, I guess. And the neural network, and at every instance, is just a random section of that projection.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. I guess I'm just exercising terminology.
Yeah.
I've never thought about probability in this way. But, okay, cool.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think this is the closest you can get to understanding why information theory doesn't speak about information, it speaks about probabilities. And it's like, I mean, if you take it, when you see information theory, it's like there's never information anywhere. There's always this kind of thing.
In a sense, right? When Shannon thought of this stuff, he was very clear it was about reproducing information.
Yeah.
That he wasn't thinking about semantics. And somehow, when you place the probability distribution as related to these neural networks, it's like you're bringing back in the semantics.
Mm-hmm.
It's so, you know, if all you care about is dog land, you don't see the semantics.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There's all this other connectivity there, which is the semantics. So you're doing a little more than just Shannon theory. I love it.
But, okay. Anyway, that was just an example. I don't do that in real life. But anyways, so this is how you compare two probability distributions when you have access to very long sequence of outcomes from it. And so in some sense, you're comparing the average or the typical behavior of your two probability distributions. But you know, there are some instances in life in which typical behaviors are not really what you're interested in. And a typical example of this is civil engineering, in which, let's say, your random variable now is the horizontal displacement of your bridge, the center of your bridge. And then you have these two probability distributions you have to compare. And if you check the relative entropy of these two, since, okay, this is out of scale, this is like 10 to the minus 3, this will be, the relative entropy will be really close, because basically almost every time, the instances from P will be the same as Q. But as we all know, bridges come with a range of motion in which they are safe. As soon as you are outside of that range of motion, then, well, the bridge will collapse. And so using the relative entropy to assessing whether the engineer you contracted to do the bridge made a good work or not, well, that's a bad quantifier. So in order to...
Did you use that graphic before that ship knocked down the Key Bridge?
Yeah.
In Baltimore?
Yeah, yeah, actually, first time was 1 year ago, so... we had our fair amount of bridge collapsing in Italy, so
oh,
I think...
Yeah.
Well, it's a different type of bridge to the one in Baltimore, and in fact, if the Baltimore bridge had been a suspension bridge like that one, it might not have been quite so catastrophic.
Yeah, but it's very similar to the one...
outside of the river completely, then it wouldn't have hit.
Yeah, it's very similar to the one collapsed in Italy, though. So, so there's a whole family of different quantifiers that were introduced in statistics, which are called the Reni divergences, that are in which you have this alpha as a parameter, and they take this form, which the only important part is this. So basically, for alpha going to zero, this gives you back the relative entropy. But as alpha goes to infinity, this will focus your attention more and more on extreme events. So in particular, even if these two probability distributions are very similar as when compared with relative entropy, with alpha going to infinity, well, they will start to be more and more different. And you will start noticing this Q is not what you really want.
I have a funny question.
Yes.
Is that bridge example, I've always wondered to myself, why are peaks of a distribution called modes? But when you use the bridge example, I'm like, oh yeah, you have all these other modes you can excite and from a probability. You don't know if that's why they're related.
No, I don't. I have no idea.
You're literally talking about these other modes.
Yeah, but I don't know if it's related, but yeah. I don't know.
So you don't know all those modes, yeah.
Yeah. So anyways, basically, if you look at the literature now, most, like, let's say 90% of the statistical quantifier you can find have all this structure, in which you have an average of a function of a ratio between the two probabilities. So in an effort to bringing everything on the same footage, a Hungarian mathematician called Cesar introduced these G divergences. He calls it F divergences for some reason. And basically, he looks at these quantities, and it requires some properties in order for these functionals to be good statistical quantifiers. The first thing is positivity, because of course you want your probability distribution to be like finitely far away from each other and never negatively far away. And homogeneity means that if you multiply everything by lambda as a positive scalar, the lambda factorizes outside, and this is by construction, nothing weird happening there. Joint convexity is a bit more complicated because it has this very long expression. But basically, it just tells you that if you have two experiments, one in which you have P1 and Q1, one in which you have P2 and Q2, and you access one of the two experiments, tossing a coin, which is biased with bias lambda, but you know the outcome of the coin, you have some amount of information. If you forget about the outcome of the coin, the amount of information will decrease. And this is in the meaning of joint convexity. So another requirement we ask is that this G should be locally smooth. And the reason why we do so is because we want to look at how they behave when Q is similar to P. Where similar means that this the P is small enough. So thanks to convexity and the fact that this function is positive, we can Taylor expand. And when P is equal to Q, it will be your contrast function will be 0. Then the first derivative will be 0, because the 0 is the only minimum you have of your functional. And so basically, what you are all left with is the second term of your Taylor expansion. And in particular, if you rewrite this thing in matrix form, where we introduce this eta xy, which is a diagonal matrix in which basically eta xx is 1 over p, you can see that this has three properties. One that is symmetric, as is a positive matrix. Then it's positive, because 1 over p, p is a probability distribution, it's always positive. And moreover, if you restrict to probability vectors that are full support, that is, they don't have any zero in their outcomes, then it will be also smooth in p. So this gives you, like, this expansion actually tells you two things. The first is that all contrast functions, even if we started off with a continuous family, all contrast functions are locally described by the same quantity. And this quantity, called Fisher information, is actually a metric. Because these three properties are the defining property of a metric. So that was everything for information. Let's put the two things together.
So I'm sure of what you're saying. Of course, it's well known that the standard relative entropy limits to Fisher when the distributions are. So what you're saying is anything that satisfies your criteria has to have that property.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
So all the Rennie divergences and
so locally basically. It has to be the same thing as Fisher.
Yeah. So far we introduced these four properties, and they were statistical properties. But what's very interesting is that just using this tool, this implies a property called monotonicity. And this means that if you take P and Q and start evolving them in time with some stochastic map MBC, stochastic maps are just CP maps for classical things, and then you start comparing the information, the relative, like as quantified by contrast functions as time evolves, well, this will decrease or stay the same. So basically, what we found is that information decreases under noisy transformation. And this is just a consequence of how we define the things. If you go to local, if you start looking at things locally, actually, it's even more strong. Because we said that all contrast functions are locally described by this eta. Well, there's a theorem by Chernsov that tells you that among all possible metrics you have on the state on the space of probability distribution, there is only one that is contractive under all noisy transformation. And this only one is the Fisher information metric. So before, we found like a characterization of the Fisher information as the local behavior of statistical quantifiers. Now we find that the Fisher information is the only metric that is contractive, monotonic, under all noisy transformation. That is, the requirement that information decreases under noisy transformation constrains the local behavior of your statistical quantifiers. And this is, I mean, so far, everything we spoke about was classical. I will do very small detour into the quantum regime and tell you why we won't see quantum things written out apart from here. And the reason is that everything becomes very formally complicated. That is, you need a lot of formalism. For example, the relative entropy becomes this thing where L and R are left and right multiplication operators. You don't need to know what this is. But also the Fisher information, and this is actually important, becomes a super operator. And there's now a difference that your Fisher operator actually knows which G you started off with. Whereas before we had a unique quantity, now there's a dependence on the contrast function you use. And actually, if you look at some of this J, well, they have quite different appearances. For example, this is the one you will see whenever someone is speaking about quantum Fisher information, it means this one, 90% of the people. All the other are also quantum Fisher information. This comes from the expansion of the relative entropy. This is used for retrodiction. That one, just to tell you that Fisher information, like Fisher information operators, are not CP in general. Because so far, everything was in Krauss form. And that one is to tell you that actually does not need to be in Krauss form. And if you want to see a, like, whoopsie. Well, this is a whole table of things, again, that this is just to justify why we are not speaking about quantum stuff. You can find this table in one of our papers. Yes?
Can you explain what L, like L and R are? L sigma and R pi.
This thing?
I know, like, in the top right corner, I'm sure.
Ah, yeah. Left and right multiplication operators. So it takes, so basically, L sigma of A. Same thing with the right thing, but on the right.
Okay.
Really, you don't need to know about this. I mean, you can know about this. It's interesting, but the first time it's a bit scary.
Wait, there's no P? Pi is the new P, basically.
Pi is the new P, yeah. So PQ now is pi sigma, Greek letters for quantum states, and Latin for classical states.
So about this function g of x, you have one different measure for each one of those functions, right? But like, how do you choose those functions? Like, where do these specific?
There's a one-to-one. No, well, there's a correspondence between g to f. You can write it down how you pass from one to the other.
Yeah, but like even f, because I was thinking that like g or f just defines what is going to be the measure that you're using, what is the type of entropy that you're using.
Yeah, so
why are these specific functions of interest? Why do we have so many different measures?
Yeah, because basically all of these kind of appear in the literature.
Ah.
So at least this part, you can say, OK, for example, you want the Rennie entropies, Rennie divergences. But also, basically, you want the Rennie divergences. If you are not a statistician, because these are really the ones that are used the most. And already this gives rise to a whole family of different Fisher information. But there's also another reason why you want many different Fisher information. That is, here, you knew that this eta came from the local expansion of Hg. Okay. Here, you know the same. But on top of that, can also say that this eta was actually defined by the Chernsov theorem, by the fact that this is contractive under all noisy transformation. So actually, when you do the quantum version and you say, OK, why we have a family here and we don't have one single thing, the answer to that is that there is a Chernsov theorem for quantum Fisher information that is called, it's by Petz, and tells you that this whole family that I gave you is all the metrics that are contracting under Fisher under CPT maps. So basically, if you only select one, you lose this connection. You lose the fact that these are exactly the metrics which contract under all maps. So it's like You can choose one, and people usually do. But from a foundational point of view, or well, a fundamental point of view, it's taking away part of the power of feature information, the this connection with the dynamics.
Yeah. You would want the right side and the left side to agree when sigma and pi are simultaneously diagonalized.
Yeah. Whenever this is the diagonal, sorry, when delta p and p commute, this is just the multiplication by 1 over p. Mm-hmm. P minus 1.
So is it easy to state what the principle is for going beyond the case where they are simultaneously diagonalized?
Well, this f should be a matrix monotone function. That means that it has a property that basically says that if A is less than B has two positive matrices, then FA less than FB.
But I mean, even on the first line, in going from the classical side to the quantum side, you want them to agree when you have commutativity.
Yeah.
But how, there must be something that constrains what you write down when they don't commute. So I just want.
Okay. This part.
Yeah.
It's like, it's a matter of taste.
Okay.
This part, it's actually well defined because of this Petz theorem. That like this one is it's the only right family. There are many possible non-local behavior. And if you want, this is another justification why this family is the right one. Because it expands to what we know as the right quantum Fisher information family. But it's really like different authors use different things. Maybe the nice part of this is that it gives you back the relative entropy, and that's all. It's like, but other than that, it's very difficult to give a justification for it. Yeah.
You show four type of metrics. they have parameters, or they each one is uniquely defined. What is it?
Each one comes from a different G. So it's like so this one. Well, let's say this one comes from the relative entropy. This one.
Parameters, just four classes.
No, it's not the four classes. It's four examples. The class is like, there's a whole family. And also this table is not exhaustive. There are more than that. It's like.
Are you going to talk about F?
Sorry?
There's this really special F that you have. Are you going to?
No.
Okay.
But if you want, we can talk in private because it's a.
Discover it or does it?
No, no. This is Petz's work.
This is Petz.
Yeah.
Okay. I don't understand the statement of the Petz theory that you showed that these are only the only metrics. What are the only metrics? What are the classification there? What is the classification?
So basically, you have this HG defined like this with G matrix convex function, and same. Properties that we said before, they all expand to this family, and this family is the same as Petz found.
With an F to define that.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's a huge family of things.
Yeah. Okay.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
So maybe you can go to the next slide or replace that thing on the bottom. With, I don't know, maybe there was further, is there something further?
No, we're right here, maybe before. I don't know. Tell me the question and I'll find it.
Yeah, so that's fine. I was remembering something that wasn't there. So the bottom statement up there, that's a local statement in about the Fisher metric. And so it's a local statement in the tangent space to the manifold at the state.
Yeah.
And the states pi and quantum mechanics are positive trace one operators. So you're in that manifold, and this is a local statement in the manifold. The top statement is somehow about transport
way away from pi.
Yep.
And what you're telling me is any non-local map that satisfies your property compared to quantum states is locally this Fisher information in the tangent space.
Mm-hmm.
Is there some way I can think about transport across the manifold that gets me from sigma to pi and it's connected with
yep.
the mapping and maybe is a connection?
Yeah, no, totally. And actually, the reason why everyone uses this one, the B one, is because it's the only one for which we know geodesics of. And in particular, if you take the geodesic distance associated to each of the metric, that's also a contrast function. Not in this family, it's different. But I mean, if you want just a statistical quantifier, that works. And there's a like the way in which this is produced is quite nice, quite neat.
Mm-hmm.
It's basically, yeah, it's completely geometric and well, mm-hmm. it's very connected also to basically this very phase, but for full rank states.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I mean, as I was saying, this thing of the choice of these functions is a bit matter of taste. But then all of them should expand locally to the quantum Fisher information matrix because we have this other characterization by pets. OK. So we were here. And basically, what we were saying is that we had, on one side, physical evolution, on the other side, statistical quantifiers. And all this discussion about monotonicity, how monotonicity constrains locally what you can do, kind of tells you, I mean, suggests the fact that physical evolution are there, and they constrain the way in which statistical quantifiers can act. So they are more fundamental. They are the one that you use to define the other. Now, basically, I guess the only result I'll show, because I'm running a bit low on time, is the opposite direction. But it's very short. So this theorem is, I'll do it for classical things. And then I'll tell you how you do the quantum version as well. So consider a linear map, A, that has two properties. One, it maps at least one positive vector into another positive vector. And the other one, that on positive vectors, it's Fisher contractive. And what does this mean? Well, take the full space of states, S, that are the probability vectors, so positive vector summing to 1. You map it with A. And the two requirements are, the first one is that there should be some overlap. So like there's at least one point that is mapped within S. Since it's a linear map, it would be a whole neighborhood that is mapped inside S. Second part is telling you that now if you focus on only this highlighted part that is on the overlap, then the Fisher information here should be smaller than the pre-image here. So basically, we don't know how to define the Fisher information outside of the space of states. Wherever it's defined, your map is contracted. That's it. Everything we require. The theorem tells you that the image of S under A is completely inside S, which means that actually this was the case from the very beginning. In other words, for classical things, means that A is physical. For quantum things, means that A, if it's a like a emission preserving map, means that A is positive. Maps all positive states to positive states. Say you don't like Fisher information because this is the first time you heard about it in your life. Why should you use it? compared to relative entropy that is there from the first class you did in quantum mechanics. Well, a direct corollary of this is that you can do the same with the relative entropy. This HL is the relative entropy, and if the relative entropy after you evolved is smaller than one you started off with, for every 2 points that are mapped inside S, so basically the same thing as before. Well,
so I'm kind of missing the difference between positivity and complete positivity here.
Here we are classical, so same thing.
Oh, it's classical, so we don't have to worry about that.
Yeah. Also. Yep.
This one, is there any linear map that is not stochastic matrix in this definition?
Sorry again?
Any linear map that is not stochastic matrix in this definition?
You start with any linear map.
Okay.
And then you ask that it satisfies these two things. And I'm telling you, the only maps that can satisfy these two things are stochastic.
Okay, I see.
Yeah.
It's stochastic in the
yeah. So it's like, I mean, you start without knowing what A is, but then as soon as you check this two condition, that is basically this condition, well, you know that it will be stochastic. And so quantum. If you have phi as a channel, now you need to go to a bigger space, that is the space of state tensor itself. And we do the same thing, basically, saying it maps at least one state into a state. And then phi tensor, the identity, is Fisher contractive, wherever it is defined. Again, always the same thing. Whenever you are mapped into a vector in which you can define the Fisher information, that Fisher information decreases. This is the case, then phi is completely positive. Bit notation there, but that's the message. And what I was saying before is that if you don't put the tensor ancillary state, and you just check on one state, you cannot distinguish between positivity and complete positivity. So you can prove the positivity of your map, but you need to go to a bigger map to actually know, a bigger space to actually know the difference between the two things. Yeah.
With the Fisher contractive here, is that for one of the metrics that was compatible?
Any metrics, yeah.
Or just any of the?
Yeah, that's also one of the reasons why we don't need to dwell into the peculiar things of the, you take any of them, you can actually find counterexamples which are commutative. So everything collapses to the same one.
You need to take any of them or all of them?
Any. One of
only
them.
Only one of the metrics is enough.
Yeah. Okay. Because basically what you use that is that the counterexample is commutative. For commutative, that is this delta rho, well, basically the tangent vector it commutes with the base point in which you are. In that case, all the metrics collapse into the single one that is the classical one. Yes, it should be like the case. I mean, you're extending classical thing to quantum, and it should agree on whenever everything commutes. And this is the case. And so we see that if Fisher contractive, then you can, like all the construction you can do with the diagonal things.
Fisher contractive for only one F.
For only one F, yeah. Implies for all F, actually. Yeah. Yeah.
Do you know how this compares to Lindblad operators? You know, so Lindblad operators are about infinitesimally generated CPTP maps have generators that look like.
Yeah.
And so Fisher contractive is kind of like infinitesimally generated CPTP map.
Yep.
And I just don't know if you think they're equivalent or if one includes the other. There's kind of like a Lindblad way of thinking about this.
So our first work was everything with Lindblad.
Uh-huh.
It was a characterization of non-Markovianity.
Uh-huh.
So
yeah, absolutely.
And the, actually, what came later was the fact that even if everything is infinitesimal, even if you have phi that is a finite step, so it doesn't need even to have a Lindblad that generates it, well,
sure enough.
Then it still holds. So it's like the natural approach to this is with the infinitesimal evolutions, but you can, it's like, actually, this is the most fundamental one.
So you can, you somehow know how to think about Fisher contractive independent of infinitesimally generated. Is that what you're?
Yeah.
And give an example. Like,
no. Well, I'll tell you the proof. So we were doing like this, no? And you say, in all of this, the Fisher is contractive. So you take any point outside that gets mapped outside, okay? And any point that gets mapped inside, okay? This segment has this pre-image. The Fisher information in the interior of the space of states is a bounded operator. As soon as you go close to the boundary, it becomes unbounded operator. So you know, it's like, this is all the proof. Very stupid. It's very strange. No one thought about it before. So actually, one of the message of this talk is Fisher information is something good to talk about, to think about, because no one looked into this direction. And you can prove nice results just with the...
At this boundary...
There are divergences. So it cannot be Fisher contractive.
Yeah, I don't understand your reasons, but I absolutely... Oh, my God.
Well, OK.
Sorry. I had a question. Yes. I think it's great that Fisher information is at the heart of this. But maybe you can go back to your picture so I can...
Yeah.
So, of course, unitaries are among the things that are in... quantum channels, and they're sort of like identity maps from this point of view.
Yeah.
What's the analogous thing in the classical picture?
Permutations. So it's like...
Permutations.
Yeah.
But if you put the entire structure of classical mechanics under the initial thing, that is with phase space, presumably it's Hamiltonian evolutions.
Sorry, I didn't get the last part of the question.
The classical thing, So the classical thing really isn't about anything in the world. It's just about stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Stuff in the world is Hamiltonian evolution that mm-hmm. is classical. If you put that entire structure of classical mechanics underneath it, so your properties were on phase space, presumably it would be Hamiltonian evolutions, just like mm-hmm. it is in quantum mechanics.
Mm-hmm.
That is, they would be the analog of identity maps.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I guess it would be something basically one parameter family of permutations, like something. But I don't know, because permutation is really binary thing. So I don't know. I should think about it.
Of course, there's additional structure once you're in phase space, because you have a manifold and the cotangent bundle where the momentum lives. Mm. So you have a lot of additional structure.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah. Food for thought. Like, I never thought about it. Yeah.
If I wanted to prove something about CPTP maps using this theorem, you say I can use any quantum Fisher metric.
Yeah.
Do you have a recommendation for use? Or is it just the?
So there's let's go a bit before. So the one I would use is this one, because this is directly connected to what is called the. I don't remember how it's called, but it's connected to some kind of two norms. So it has some literature attached to this.
Okay.
And the other ones are useful. It's harder. It's harder to work with them.
But yeah.
So, can I just
comment briefly on my last question.
Yeah.
In the quantum case, you have put a huge amount of structure underneath it. The structure is Hilbert space with positive, with Hermitian operators and positive operators and unitaries. So all of that's there for your theorem to take advantage of. And in the classical case, you have no structure. So it's just permutations that are. And what I'm suggesting is the structure that should be there if you're actually dealing with classical physics is Hamiltonian mechanics. Anyway.
So, like extending these to a third case, extending the contrast function to a third case where you are in this space or classical physical states.
Uh-huh.
Because this case is just extended from information, classical information, to quantum case, but we're not considering the classical physical states. You say to go to this third domain, where there is not just information, but also some physical constraints, this asymptotic structure.
I don't think I quite got all of that, but interesting.
Yeah. Well, anyways, I think
The room is booked for another half an hour, then we have to go out.
Half an hour? That's incredible. No, I mean, I can stop here with the main message, depending on the audience, actually. There's a small detour into non-Markovianity after this. 10 more minutes.
You can talk about this.
Okay.
People wisely leave room for people to ask questions, and then you can just go on for an extra half hour and give a talk.
Yeah. So, anyways, what we were saying. We started off with this direction. Physical evolution constrains the way in which statistical quantifiers can be defined. Now we have a theorem that actually gives you the other direction. So the main message is that statistical quantifiers, like if you ask for contractivity of your whatever map you're using, constrains the physical evolution you can have in your theory. In particular, the other direction, this one going down, can also be made more precise if instead of statistical quantifier, you take Fisher information. Because in that case, you have chance of theorem, paths for the quantum version, that tells you that this is the only metric in which, for which, the only metric that contracts under any physical evolution. So in some way, our theorem is now a dual to the chance of theorem. Gives you this kind of equivalence between the two things. So, applications. So, just a brief recollection of what non-Markovianity or Markovianity is. Suppose you have your space state, and you start evolving it to a later time t or to a later time s. And now Markovianity is the characterization of this map. If this map is CP, you have Markovianity. If it's not CP, you have some non-Markovian effects. So now the two things I've written here is that if you go from here to here, the information you have will decrease. Because this one, for sure, is a CP map. This also is a CP map. So the information will decrease as well. So now the real question is, how do these two quantities, this one at the bottom and the one on the top, actually compare to each other? So like from the contractivity of, from the monotonicity of the contrast function, we have that Markovianity, that is the fact that this map is CP, implies that the information you have at this point is more than the information you have at a later point. So in other ways, Markovianity implies that over time you lose information in a monotonic way. And if you have a continuous evolution, you can also write it in a differential form, basically saying that the derivative of your information just goes down. So this is something that was known, and now applying our theorem actually tells you that this is for classical things. Monotonic contractivity implies Markovianity. So if you have that for every point that at a later time gets mapped into the space of states, the Fisher information decreases, then your evolution should be Markovian. The same thing holds for quantum things. If you don't have S here, you have S tensor S. That's always the problem with the quantum stuff. You always need bigger space. So if you see what I was saying before about the fact that this is kind of the dual of like these are two statements that are dual to each other. In one, you have Markovianity implied monotonic contractivity. In the other one, you have monotonic contractivity implies Markovianity. So in particular, non-Markovianity means that there will be some expansion of the Fisher information somewhere. So for example, if you take these two points, you map it, they will get closer, but eventually they will go far away again. And this is basically telling you that if you have no Markovianity, this will happen somewhere. But the problem is, as you see here, these two points are outside of the image of the space of states at time t. That means that if you prepare your state somewhere here, you can only end up in this blob here. So even if the Fisher information expands, there's no physical way of witnessing it, in this case, through the preparation of two states here and then following it and seeing the Fisher information becoming bigger. There are ways around it, but like at this point, it's what we see. But suppose, actually, we are not in this case, but actually, the two points that expand are in the image. So this means that there are two initial points that if you follow them, they will actually evolve into these things. Yep.
Just make clear, are you assuming that the evolution is already divisible when you?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Divisibility is something, it's like it's the ground zero of non-Markovianity. It's like some people don't even say it anymore.
So map phi s t.
Exists. Yeah. Yeah. Exists for every s and t.
You can say somehow from this that if the second law is universally valid, then you have Markovianity or something like that. You can.
Usually, second law is proved using Markovianity. Like in some sense, you say, okay, I have a Lindblad-ian evolution. Sorry.
You can go in the other direction somehow. This is what you're saying somehow.
Yeah, it's like I mean the problem is defining what second law you want. But for example, something that usually you say is that your state is out of equilibrium if it has a relative entropy that is positive with respect to.
Second law, I mean.
Yeah, OK. And then if you evolve this in time, by the contractivity of the relative entropy, you will see that this will be monotonically going down if you have Markovianity. That is, if every, I mean,
yeah,
what?
State to the last, but
yeah, exactly.
Right.
Yeah, and actually, this is a very classical argument. You can find it on the Petruccioni, for example. Like that's been there for some time. Now the thing is the other direction. So saying, suppose you have a divisible evolution, which satisfy the second law, then it should be physical. I mean, that's like the
Markovian,
yeah. It's like there's no non-Markovian evolution, which
respect the second law.
Yeah.
Crazy.
Apart from this thing, that the things that the violation could be not on the image. That's an important thing. Like, if the violation was given by these 2 points, you wouldn't be able to see that there's a violation. Mathematically, there is, because if you look at these 2 points, the official information increases. But there's no physical way of preparing any 2 states here that get mapped here, and that allows you to see that the official information is increasing. So it's a bit of a trade-off. There are ways around again. You need some kind of filters in order to basically bring these 2 things back to the like accessible space. But that's like, I mean, you can do it, but there's a lot of post-processing involved. It's not like you see a direct physical process that lives in the abstract that does this filter. Like, I mean, you need to really fine tune it and spend some time to find it. But yeah, if it's on the image, then I mean, as soon as you see an increase of like a reversal of your second law, then you know that evolution is non-Markovian. Let's say so. At least this one you can always say. And
is this your conjecture or is this something you prove?
This is something well known. Yeah, okay. And actually. Yeah, I guess if you know the book by Petruccioni about open quantum systems, there's a part about like information quantifiers and things like that. Like, well, it just does the relative entropy, and it describes this part.
I see. So this is an if and only if. Really.
Yeah. So the one it describes is this direction. We describe this other direction. We have one of the papers are referring. I will put the reference at the end, basically, but we also have the proof of that.
So if you start the evolution at an early enough time, it can be Markovian, but then if you start after a certain amount of time, you might be out of the image and things will be Markovian starting from that. Oh, not Markovian starting from
that. Yeah, and that's a problem. For example, imagine something like, you take an evolution that basically takes the whole space and brings it epsilon close to the identity. And then you continue with your non-Markovian evolution. The official information will know nothing about it. Because as basically, you can always find an epsilon that is close enough that the official information doesn't see it. There are filters, but that's that's just saving the unsavable, basically. The direct thing is there can be no Markovianity, but it can be outside of the image you have. Okay. So these discussions, usually in the non-Markovian community, are done in terms of a trace norm, which is not official information. And in particular, the nice thing about the official information is that it's a metric that is locally defines a scalar product. When you have a scalar product, you can define the adjoint of any map with respect to your scalar product. Here we do something slightly different because we change the points at which you are. But suppose, for example, rho is your fixed point. Well, this would be, this phi tilde would be exactly the adjoint of the map. Interestingly, this gives you a way of mapping back your state to basically the initial, your, like, to the states that you had at the initial part of the evolution. And classically, this is exactly what Bayes' theorem does. So this is something incredibly interesting. The fact that this adjoint you have here is directly connected with Bayes' theorem, classically, also quantumly, but there it's a bit more controversial. And the reason why this is because the Fisher information is a dynamical thing, but it's also a strongly statistical quantity. So the connection with the statistics allows you to have these features like the basically the Bayes theorem for free. So again, suppose you have this expansion of the Fisher information on the image. You applied this retrodiction map. And what we find is that non-Markovianity implies that when you retrodict at a later time, you will be closer to the initial state than if the non-Markovianity wasn't there. So basically, this resolves a problem that there is, well, that I had with the non-Markovianity community, that is, they tell you, ah, non-Markovianity, it's a backflow of information, and then they tell you this, and then they start saying, you take two states, and then they get closer together, and then they expand. And you're like, well, where is the backflow of information? You want, like, the information of your initial state to be the one thing that is coming back. I mean, it's the only sensible thing. With the trace norm, you cannot say it. Like, I mean, you can explain why the fact that the trace norm expands is a backflow of information. But the, I mean, it's a long explanation. Here, we have a direct thing. We say there's no Markovianity. Well, you do, you apply Bayes' theorem, it will be better. You will have a better estimation of your initial state. So another reason why Fisher information is cool is that basically tells you exactly what this backflow of information is. And whereas all the things we said so far about non-Markovianity up until this point were known for the trace norm, this thing about the improved retrodiction is a completely new result. Yeah, yeah, no, I was waiting for a photo.
All right, we have to take pics to keep up.
Yeah, so again, just to summarize all of this, we have this duality, and kind of the reason, like the fundamental reason why there's so much duality in here, I think it's because there's a common cause, which is something I know people here like, is the fact that everything we are doing is characterizing how information behaves. And the first thing is, like the first direction is that you use information to define what physical evolutions were. Like classical mechanically, you say it, saying there's a symmetry in time, that is, you can go forward in time, backwards in time. And this is just saying that information is conserved about any point you are at each time. This physical evolution, on the other hand, constrains how statistical quantifiers can behave. And now we have the other direction, that is, information can be, I mean, encoded in a probability distribution, and we can quantify how much information is there just from an information point of view, like information theory point of view. But then this automatically constrains the possible physical evolution you have. So I hope this was an interesting talk. And if you have some further questions and doubts, well, I'm here for a week more. And then we have a nice review. Nice, you should say, but well, we worked a lot on it. And this review is like, it's very long. But if you go to the second page, it has an index. And this is everything you have to need to know about efficient information. Everything is all the theorems, you can directly jump from to them. And basically, this is a summary of all the results that are written there. Read that, you know, more than half of the people know about efficient information. On top of it, yep.
So could you just go back to the title page so I can read who your co-authors are? Well, I can't.
No. I'll show the co-authors.
You blow that up.
I'll show the co-authors as well.
I was once at a conference that Vigner was at, and Vigner went up before doing Bill Unger's talk. What does this mean? So, I'm thank you.
Yeah. And again, to make everything more didactic, like pedagogic, we inserted also these green boxes. If you see them, means you can skip that, or unless you are very interested in that topic. And yep.
Can you write the archive serial number of that?
Thank you for the attention. And these are all the archive serial numbers. And also, thank a lot to my three co-authors, which were the small names that were written. He's now in Vienna. He's now in Normale di Pisa. He's there. Thank you.
Questions, we have 10 more minutes here.
So which of these three is the review you were just talking about?
So, non-Markovianity, mostly classical. Everything that is quantum is in the appendices. Because, I mean, it's just an extension of the classical thing. As I was saying, all the proofs are...
One with the Petz work.
And the one with Limbladians.
Okay.
Yeah. This is the review, very long, contains basically the information about the other three. And this is the main theorem. This goes a bit more in depth in this theorem one.
We found good stuff.
Yeah.
Excellent. Paolo.
I see.
Converse to the Chentzov theorem is in the right-hand one?
Yep. I mean, if you only want that, it's here, it's four pages, it's very fast.
And that
that
longer review paper, do you have any idea where it will appear published?
We are working on it.
Working on that? Okay, I mean, I don't want to push you on that. And I could go to Hakoto
and figure out how you latex those boxes. Because
I might want to know how to do that. I'm sure it's easy, but somebody has to tell you.
Yeah, I thought
I figuring out yourself is impossible, although you might have done that.
Those G entropies, those quantum G entropies that you like with the, the L R inverses. I guess those have like this adjoint homogeneity property. You know, the way that conjugating operators by some, right? If I call adjoint just conjugate by some operator, then there, everything cancels, right? Like there's this adjoint homogeneity property. If I take sigma and pi to them being conjugated by something.
Okay.
Then that conjugation just comes all the way out.
Yeah.
Is that essentially, is that the unique? Does it uniquely have that property, or are there other adjoint homogeneous?
Because you said it was a matter of taste, but I think those are very significant.
I mean, if you can give a reason why those are the right ones, I would be extremely happy.
Well, they have this adjoint homogeneity property, and I don't know if they're unique in that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Gosh.
Yeah, well, something I don't know is like most of the properties that the Fisher has, like the Fisher metric has, also it's a geodesic distance has. So something that is completely not done in the literature because it's, it's completely nuts, is using the geodesic distance of the Fisher to actually do a contrast function. You say, I just integrate along the geodesics and that's proper contrast function, it's monotonic, it's homogeneous, it has all everything you want. And usually, that's always something that, you know, whenever you want to prove a uniqueness property, then you have the geodesic distance coming there and say, hi, I'm here. And but maybe it's possible. I mean, I don't know.
Yeah, your perspective on geodesics is different from mine. I hope we can talk a little.
Yeah, sure.
Because there's something I want to show you, which would give you what my geodesic perspective is. And then maybe I can actually hear what you're saying.
Mm-hmm. Okay, nice. Yeah, for sure.
I would like to just thank you for giving a terrific talk.
Yeah, excellent.
I think I managed to figure out the answer to my question about classical mechanics.
Okay.
Classical mechanics basically is permutations relative to the literal measure of the canonical phase space. So you discretize finely enough, and classical mechanics is just, it's just permutative. There must be something about differentiability, but that's what the restriction will be. It is permutations relative to that. I mean, little things get stretched out to be a different shape, but they have the same phase space form.
Yeah, I mean, should be some kind of consequence of Liouville theorem at the end.
Yeah, Liouville's theorem.
Yeah, the thing is, classically, you can define the Fisher information for infinite dimensional system. That's very complicated. It's like, I mean, we do quantum information because we don't like to go in all of this. And I think our theorem, I mean, I'm quite sure our theorem would hold as well. I gave a sketch.
That's sort of the point. I'm sure your theorem will hold, but you can't have these sums over discrete things. You'll have to have a measure and integrate over it.
Yeah, no, not totally. Yeah. No, no, I kind of proved it. Kind of, because no one checked it, and I did it in 10 minutes, just applying the same thing, in L2. So it should hold also for like infinite dimensional thing, but well, I mean, I think if someone wants to sit down and do it correctly, it's not that difficult, potentially. Like in mathematics, every time something is trivial, it's either trivial or non-trivial.
Indeed, good project.
Absolutely. Good. So, if no further questions,
I have one bizarre question. Have you ever thought about Legendre transformations?
Sorry?
Legendre transformations.
He's the.
You like that? Oh.
It's like, he's the guy.
I mean, when I look at that G double prime of zero in front of your Fisher metric, I'm like, just, I haven't told you my perspective on geodesics. Mm-hmm. I'm just like flipping out because of, I've just been thinking too much about Legendre transformations. Okay.
So okay, I mean.
We should talk about
some. Yeah, totally.
Cheers.
Okay. Yeah. Okay, nice. Thank you.
Thanks again to the speaker.